Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining this week is a great New York State hero, Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, a man who, well, he has some ethics which are challenging to other people. Welcome back, Tom. Appreciate your being here.
Alan, it's always great to be on your show, even if I'm doing it, you know, from New York City and not being right with you in the studio like I like to do.
You don't have to tell people that. They don't know. You know. So, okay, I wrote a column which basically said what I've been saying to you all along. And, you know, you've always been very nice about it. But, you know, I am very angry at Andrew Cuomo because he and some of the galoots in the legislature passed part of their budget a while back, which basically took away from you the right to pre-audit certain important contracts. That's why we have a constitution. That's why we have a comptroller. And everybody knows, this is Alan talking now, and it's an interview with Tom DiNapoli. He may never be allowed to say anything, but everybody knows that the reason he took that away from you is, you know, he's got all these campaign funds. Everybody's giving him money, and the more pork you give out, the better it is. And if you're around to say, no, that's not a good contractor, there's something wrong with that, then what? So that's basically what my column said. I don't know if you even saw it, Tom.
Like most New Yorkers, I always look for your columns. But, you know, let's look at it another way. You know, when these changes were first proposed, it was with a notion that we need to be more efficient. And that, especially with some of the contracts related to economic development, many parts of the state struggling with job recreation, aftermath of the global financial crisis and so on, there was this notion that the controller's office is a review process that slows things down without any great benefit. You know, and obviously I had a very different point of view at the time. Unfortunately, the legislature and the governor prevailed, and our ability, as you appropriately call it, pre-audit or to review contracts ahead of time was curtailed for certain contracts related to SUNY construction contracts, what have become increasingly utilized centralized contracts through the Office of General Services. Now, Alan, since our oversight has been curtailed, about $20 billion in those OGS centralized contracts has been given without our review that we would have had previously. And the reality is our review takes really only a matter of days. If we have some questions and need clarification, it could be a week or two. Unless it's a real outlier, you know, there really is no time wasted in our contract review. So what you lose in the call for more efficiency is an independent set of eyes looking at what the transaction is. So we can perhaps catch something and look out for taxpayer dollar. We can audit something after the fact, but it doesn't do much good to say after the fact, you know, there could have been a better deal or there are some questions there. And that's why that pre-audit authority, that contract review is very important. At a minimum, we'd like to see it restored.
Well, look, I understand Andrew all too well. I've been watching him for years. You know, people give him campaign money and he wants to be able to deliver these economic development projects to them. I get that part. But you come from the legislature. Those people should have known better. I mean, what kind of knife in the back was that?
Well, you know, I don't think it was anything to take personally. Look, the reality
I take it personally.
You can take it personally on my behalf. Look,
I give the state a lot of taxes.
The controls office, independently elected, but obviously I don't have a vote in the legislature anymore. And when this is done, you know, as it often is done now, policy issues done as part of the budget process, there's a lot that's being traded back and forth. Probably no surprise that something like, you know, this item, if it was important to the executive, you know, was traded for other items. I mean, look at it. You know, let's be realistic about it. I'm not saying that like it was a personal insult. But I think, you know, we more and more recognize that we live in a time where we must put a priority, all levels of government, on accountability and transparency. That's what this office is set up to do.
But wait, I don't get it. Wait a second. The proof is in the pudding, and the pudding is quite clear on these economic development things because Andrew Cuomo had a whole bunch of friends, and they're all, you know, being tried in court now, or many of them are, for having taken these contracts and having had their way with them. You know what I mean? And so so Joe Prococo, his so-called brother, and all these other guys are on trial. If Tom DiNapoli had had a look in, maybe, I'm not saying absolutely, but maybe things would have been different. You would have caught these guys before they did their disgusting work.
Well, there obviously are some serious charges out there. And I think your last point is a key one. I've never said in restoring our oversight and some of the other reforms that's in our proposal guarantees that bad things won't happen. But it makes it less likely. Why? Because perhaps we would catch something, number one. Number two, before someone thought they could conspire to get away with something, they might say, oh, you know, the controls office is going to review it. Maybe we better not try to pull this off. One of the other pieces of the reforms that we're proposing, which is separate from that question of our restoring our review power, Alan, is this use of the SUNY system and these nonprofits as a very opaque and non-transparent way to funnel money to these economic development projects. The use of those nonprofits, you know, which years ago when they were first used by SUNY, you know, often was, you know, to get a piece of property, you know, for a development project. And now we've seen so much in terms of economic development money, you know, flowing through Empire State Development, then SUNY, and then to a nonprofit. It's very hard to track that money. And there is no review. The more you take it away from the normal state agency process. And that's a lot of what, you know, I've been advocating. Let the review process be the same as it is for state agencies. And unfortunately, SUNY has a very important mission, right, on higher education, and certainly economic development can be a parallel priority. But to use the SUNY mechanism in the way that it's been used has really done nothing more than to evade the kind of scrutiny that state spending should have. And that takes something away from the transparency that taxpayers certainly deserve, the accountability that the legislature and the press and everybody else should be informed as to how you track this money. And so part of our reform is don't use these nonprofit entities anymore. Again, have the money flow in a more transparent and open way. I hope that'll be considered as part of the reform discussion on procurement. I think that's as important as what we're calling for in terms of restoring our oversight authority.
So what are the chances here? Look, sorry to be so tough on Cuomo, but I am. The idea that he says, okay, well, we took away that authority from the constitutional guy, the guy who was given that authority by the New York State Constitution. And, you know, we've been using it for ourselves, but now we're not going to give it back to him. Now I'm going to appoint somebody else, some other investigator who reports to me. That's no good. That doesn't pass the stink test.
Yeah, I mean, I think independence is key. I think, you know, to look at transactions after the fact, which is typically what a prosecutor or an inspector general would do, you know, while that may be of some value, what we really need to do is look at the front end so we could avoid problems.
No, but the point, Tom, I'm sorry, Tom, the point is that the inspector general he wants to appoint will report to him. So
no,
it's,
that's the independence question, but usually an IG will look at something after that. That's usually not a pre-approval role. Look, Alan, I've always been a believer. Right, I'm the optimist. You're getting too cynical now. Come on, be the optimist. Enlightened self-interest. It will be in the interest, not just for this governor, for any governor, for the legislature as well, to be able to say there's an independent review going on beforehand. And you know what, Alan? Then if something still goes off the rails, you could say, hey, wait a minute. You know, the controller over there was like, he didn't catch it. Instead, when you have something go off the rails now, there's a very clear line of responsibility. And this, I think, is protecting of these programs, protective of the executive, protective of the legislature to have our review. Enlightened self-interest, Alan, I can't say that our proposal is going to be enacted exactly as we've written it. I've been around Albany long enough to know you have to be open to engage in discussion and find common ground. But my hope, based on what I'm hearing from rank-and-file legislators and even some of what the leaders have been saying of late, there will be some version of procurement reform that will include this independent review. How it'll look, it may be a little different than what I've been advocating for, but as long as that independence piece is in there, I'm going to be optimistic that we're going to get something before session ends this year.
Okay, so I'm a cynic. So what if I tell you that if you get the legislature to go along, which is obviously a very good idea, and they do it, you think that that governor isn't going to veto that bill?
No, my assumption is that anything that would get to the floor would probably be something that'll be negotiated, including with the input of the governor. So, you know, the question in my mind is really more, I mean, look, hey, when we do the show in July, if nothing happened, you know, you've proved me wrong. I'm going to be optimistic and say something's going to happen. It'll be part of a process that'll have input from our office, governor's office, both houses of the legislature. And if there's enough of the independence in there, even if it's not everything that I'm advocating for, we'll be able to say it's a step forward. So that's my view of how it'll play out. I would be surprised if something would end up on the governor's desk that he didn't have some input into and he would find acceptable.
Okay, fine. All I'm going to say, and I guess it's enough now, is I'm disgusted with what Cuomo has done to you, and I just think it's ridiculous. And I don't know what his political motives are, but, you know, this is bullying tactic. I don't like it. Let me switch subjects to immigration. I want to know how much do illegal immigrants contribute to New York State's economy? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, I can't give you a dollar figure, but, you know, immigrants, legal, illegal, they're part of the economy. At a minimum, you know, sales tax, you know, when they buy goods and services, and sales tax is a big revenue source to the state. Obviously, many of these folks end up working, so they are part of business. It's interesting, Alan. I did a tour, going back a couple of years now, of farms upstate New York. And what was the big issue when I was talking to the farmers that they're worried about? It wouldn't be any of the more obvious agricultural concerns that you might expect. Their concern was a crackdown on immigration. And they said the reality is we at harvest time, we can't get our work done if we don't have the immigrants. And that's putting aside question legal or illegal, but obviously some of them probably don't have their papers in order. Why? Because the people that are here, the young people that grow up in these communities, they don't want to do the work. And,
sure.
and it's the immigrants that come to do it. So I can't give you a dollar amount. That's probably very hard to do, but it's certainly very obvious that immigrants are, because you asked the question in terms of illegal, right? You know, in terms of legal, we know it's billions of dollars of impact. I mean, not just in New York City, but across the state. You know, the economic impact of immigration is very significant. So you asked the question on illegal, and that's obviously harder to put a number on, but I could tell you just anecdotally, there are many sectors of our economy that depend on that workforce. And obviously in the overwhelming majority of instances, these are hardworking people that often are working long hours, sending money back home, and would very much love to be not illegal, but to have papers in order. So, you know, obviously in New York, we don't control the federal immigration policy, but if we are so overdue in this country to having a rational proposal on immigration reform to provide a pathway for citizenship, and, you know, obviously with everything going on in Washington, I don't know that we'll see that anytime soon, but New York has always been the gateway for immigrants, and we need to make that as easy as possible for those immigrants, many of whom, most of whom really want to stay here, for them to become citizens.
You just mentioned the magic word, Washington, where they've just passed what I consider to be a horrendous health care bill repealing and replacing Obamacare. Of course, it has to go to the Senate. Your thoughts?
Well, from a moral perspective, it's an outrage. I mean, people are going to get sicker, and I hate to be alarmist, but some people are going to die when they don't have access to health care like they've had. I look at it from the perspective of being the controller, and the governor's made this point, and he's absolutely right. You know, this could punch a real hole in our budget, state budget, at a time that we finally have the budget in much better shape. We had estimated at the front end, you know, months ago when this was all first being talked about, could cost the state about $5.7 billion in lost revenue, mostly through the Medicaid program. You know, now I'm seeing figures, you know, over $6 billion, and you're talking about a huge number of New Yorkers that would be losing health care that have it now. And then you have this other little gimmick that they threw in to mandate only New York State, right, that the state pick up all the local share of Medicaid. By the way, a worthy goal, and I carried a bill to do that over time when I was in the state assembly, but to do it overnight, the so-called Collins Amendment, that would punch another hole of about $2 billion in our budget. So there's a fiscal impact on the state. There's a quality health care impact on the state for probably millions of New Yorkers that wouldn't have access to health care. So what do we want them to do? Show up sick at the emergency room, like we've been trying to get away from, and have the charity pools, pay for people that don't have health care coverage and have them show up when they're sicker and further along and it costs more money or have more devastating consequences. So this is really so poorly thought out. They wouldn't even, as you know, Alan, let the Congressional Budget Office mark up the cost impact of the bill before they rush to vote it because they finally suddenly got just enough votes to pass it. What is the Senate going to do? Who knows? I mean, obviously they're not rushing to, and they won't rubber stamp what the House did. But, what are they going to do? Obviously, the Republicans do control the majority. They've made this issue of Obamacare, which might be more about erasing Obama's legacy than about the specific health care policy. But putting that aside, they're probably going to do something. What is the replacement going to look like? How much leverage can our two senators have in that process? I hope with Senator Chuck Schumer's minority leader, he can have a lot of leverage in those negotiations.
Now, Tom DiNapoli, I can't sit here with you today and not ask you about the firing of James Comey as the FBI director. Here you are, you're a state official, but you're watching like the rest of us are, CNN glued, I'm sure, to the tube to see what's, or to NPR to see what's going on. You got any thoughts on this?
Well, I think like many people, I've been scratching my head, about Comey for a while. I'm not sure he's always exercised the best judgment in many of these situations. But you look at the timing on this, you have obviously a stepped up investigation on the Russian ties to our election process and on some of the folks tied very closely to the president. And that investigation seems to be ramping up. So the timing to let Comey go when things are really seeming, as much as we know, right, to be heating up in terms of what the FBI is doing, does raise that question. We talked about independence earlier, in terms of, sure, of oversight. Comey's not, say, the most sympathetic figure, right, with some of the things he's done. But is this timing having more to do with the fact that they're getting close on asking some really hard questions of people that could be very embarrassing? Or is it about punishing Comey for missteps that he had along the way? It does get back to, and obviously there are a lot of calls now for, it's a special commissioner or a special prosecutor or some independent role to look at all these questions. So
how do you get that independence? I mean, how do you get the independence? You got a new attorney general.
Congress would have to set something up. You're beginning to feel like we're back, back in some of those horrible days we can remember, when the Nixon administration was kind of unraveling. And I mean, I don't know that it's quite unraveling, but we're on a roller coaster. So, our seatbelts have been fastened since Election Day. But I guess we got to fasten them even tighter because what's so troubling to me, Alan, is all of this saps so much energy and attention. We have so many. I mean, we talked about, the health care issue. If the Senate is going to be consumed now in how they're going to have oversight on the investigations, what kind of attention to detail are they going to be putting on health care? What about immigration reform that nobody's even talking about anymore? And what about this world we're living in, with Syria and still present in Afghanistan? We lost a soldier in Somalia the other day. What's happening in North Korea? You go down the long list. We're going to be spending all our time now, debating about who's running the FBI and what did Flynn do or not do, or what about the business deals for the president, and what about the election that's now months away, past us and behind, and we got to look in the rearview mirror. We got some big issues out there that we have to be dealing with, and I just see Washington as just being consumed in a way that's going to be a total distraction. So, what we're doing in the states becomes even more important, that we hold up our end of the bargain about how we need to serve people.
You bet. I know that there have been groups who have been calling on you to divest in our fund. You're the sole trustee, although you have a lot of people doing work, to divest the funds invested in fossil fuels. I know that you've said in the past your job is to make sure that there's a return on taxpayers' money that you're responsible for investing. But what about that? Should we not be investing in fossil fuels, especially with this current administration in Washington?
Well, let me say, first of all, the folks that advocate for that, we're on the same page. I see climate change and climate risk as a major threat, perhaps the existential threat to our planet. And to me as an investor, it's a threat in terms of our investments, not just with fossil fuels, but any of our investments. Every entity we invest in has a carbon footprint. They need to be reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We all need to contribute to the solution on climate change. I was at the Paris climate talks. I was invited to be on one of the panels. I support the Paris Agreement. But, you know, and I don't mind that they raise the issue because I think it's an important discussion. But look where we're at with this administration in Washington, cutting the EPA, you know, budget, you know, decimating it. We'll see what happens with what they do with the Paris Agreement. The enemy of the issue on climate change is not pension funds, because we have some of our money in fossil fuel companies. A lot of that money, Alan, is through our index funds. It's passively invested. And if anybody looks at their own, if they do investing, you know, if they're in a mutual fund, everybody's got an allocation to energy, including oil and gas. So we're not invested in oil and gas because we're denying climate change. Well, just the opposite. We have set up, I think we've talked about on your show in the past, a very unique, groundbreaking index that incentivizes investments in companies, not just fossil fuel or oil and gas companies, any company that is disclosing their emissions and has a plan of action to reduce those emissions. And we don't have any coal in that index. We have $2 billion in that index. It's doing well. It's making money for us. We want to do more to incentivize companies to do the right thing. We're fighting with ExxonMobil right now because we have a seat at the table as a shareholder. We have a resolution that got 38% vote last year. We hope to get it passed this year to say, ExxonMobil, what are you doing to adjust your business plan to the reality of the emerging low-carbon economy? What are you doing to deal with climate risk? How are you changing how you do your business? If we divest, we have no seat at the table. You know, so I'd rather have a seat at the table, try to press the oil and gas companies, fossil fuel companies, to do the right thing, to recognize climate change as a reality. They've got to change the way they do business. To just divest, that's not going to put these companies out of business. And, you know, to me, the fight on climate risk right now and climate change, it's not public pension funds that are doing work responsibly as investors. We got to get to the climate deniers that are now running the administration in Washington. That really should be the battlefront. So we're on the same page in terms of goal. We have different tactics and strategies to get there. But our overarching goal, Alan, you said it before, we have to make money for the pension fund. I've got 1.1 million New Yorkers that depend on it. The reality is we still make money on these investments. And while we are diversifying our portfolio and doing more with green investing, you know, it's still part of the mix. And you know, we're not going to cut it all off tomorrow.
Okay, we only got 3 minutes. I want to ask you a real fast question, and I hope that you'll give me a real fast answer. Who replaces Preet Bharara as the U.S. attorney now? That was a series of very important investigations before he was firing Comey of the FBI. That was Trump. He was firing Preet Bharara after he told him how well he was doing, as he did with Comey. You got any ideas on that could take like a minute?
Well, it's easy because that's way beyond my pay grade. I haven't even heard that many names. Southern District is the premier showcase prosecutorial position. Let's hope they come up with the best.
Indeed, that's right. Now, when you are aware of a government fraud, of somebody doing a fraud on the government, we got 2 minutes here, and you find it, you can't make an arrest. Who do you have to go to?
We deal with prosecutors and law enforcement. So there's a combination of ways. So we have a great collaboration with our wonderful Attorney General Eric Schneiderman on public integrity issues. Our teams work together. When we find something, we do a referral that confers on him, right, because he has civil jurisdiction, criminal jurisdiction. We work closely with district attorneys across the state, U.S. Attorney's Office. We have a great collaboration. So our investigative unit works with our auditors, and depending on what the corruption or the infraction is, then we will work with the appropriate prosecutorial agency. Sometimes we work with the FBI as well. There are some federal inspector generals that have jurisdiction in this area. So we have strong collaborations with those that can take what we find to the next step.
We've been talking with our wonderful friend, our guest, a man I much admire, New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. Tom, thanks so much for joining us. You just keep on doing what you're doing. You're terrific. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Alan. Always great to be with you. Thanks.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. Thank you.
Thank you.